Hello and welcome to the OnFifth podcast, the weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. In today's podcast, I'll be speaking to Professor Michael Sung, who's an associate professor of finance at the Fenhai International School of Finance at Fudan University. He has a long history of entrepreneurship as a tech venture builder and investor, and he's also a member of the CVC Committee for the World Digital Economy Council and the China Digital Finance Advisory Group. We're going to be speaking about the People's Bank of China's digital RMB project, the broader Chinese payments ecosystem, and how those two themes relate to China's ambitions to internationalize the renminbi. Thank you to Michael for joining us today. I wanted to start off our discussion by situating the PBOC's digital RMB in the broader context of the Chinese payments ecosystem. I think anyone who's been following this discussion over the past couple of years will be familiar with developments such as Alipay or WeChat Pay, and how those have represented sort of a big step forward in payments. And I'm wondering if you can help us figure out how the digital RMB project relates to those developments. Why don't we start off there?
So as you know, China is really taking a lead in the mobile payments market. It's largely a digitized ecosystem already, right? 95% of the mobile payments in China are already done by the duopoly that you mentioned. And so there's actually quite a substantive amount of transactional volume. It's a multiple of that of the United States. And so all of China's basically relatively digitized. In that context, right, because both Alipay and WeChat Pay are private institutions, there is very little participation from the traditional finance sector in terms of the state-owned enterprise banks. And so there is a concern by the Chinese government with respect to the resiliency of the financial ecosystem. And so that actually is one of the main drivers for the rapid development of the digital RMB, to be able to create a digital payment infrastructure that can essentially level the playing field for the rest of the traditional banking sector by giving them the financial infrastructure tools, also because of the digitization, to give them the opportunity to leverage big data, the credit risk analysis, and all the techniques that Ant Financial and WeChat Pay have to be able to develop new markets and be competitive in that space.
You mentioned concerns about financial resilience from the Chinese government. Can you elaborate what those concerns revolve around?
Yeah, I think in general, if you look at the development of China over the last few decades, the focus of the government has been directed at certain things, right? So in the 80s to 90s, it was the reform of going from a communist system and the economy opening up and adopting sort of capitalist principles, right? And then in the 90s to 2000, there was an industrialization phase. The focus was in developing the critical infrastructure and the capacity building for that stage. And then in the mid 2000s to 2015 timeframe, there was a big focus on getting up to speed with technological innovation, right? And so now I think we're moving into another phase where the government is really focused on now developing the financial ecosystem and making sure that it's robust, and that a big concern in that is the resiliency, as I mentioned before, and the reduction of risk, and the sort of compliance and the modern sort of financial safeguards to create a more robust and dynamic capital market and financial ecosystem, right? And so with that focus now, for the next, say, few 5-year plans. The Chinese government tends to work in 5-year plans. We're on the 14th iteration of the next 5-year plans. There's basically the next 15 years to the midway point before you get to 2049 at the 100th anniversary of China. China is now planning that far ahead in terms of how they want to do this, right? And a big factor in that is to create the checks and balances, and again, sort of the resiliency. And when we're talking about resiliency, that means that it cannot have a single failure mode, right? If there was a systemic risk because Ant Financial had financial trouble, let's say, right, that would take down half of the payment capability in the country, right? So therefore, this is a major concern. And of course, the central government would also like its own state-owned enterprise financial actors, you know, the four major banks and, you know, all the other institutions to be able to have more say and also participation in the market, to create a multipolar market where all these actors and stakeholders can interact in a more meaningful manner, right? I mean, I think the equivalent would be if in the United States, you know, Facebook had come up with a payment system and owned most of the, you know, payment online ecosystem in the United States. I think the regulators there would also be concerned with that, right? So I think it's a pretty well-reasoned concern to create a more equitable playing field for an ecosystem. And the digital RMB will facilitate that.
I like that you mentioned the sort of five-year plan context. And one of the other major elements of the 14th five-year plan, as you mentioned, the sort of main macro plank is the sort of dual circulation model, right? And specifically, I think there's quite a clear link between this kind of payments resilience and the sort of the push to rely more on internal circulation, so sort of domestic consumption, things like that have previously been slightly sort of weaker growth drivers. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So if you looked at decades past, again, in the industrialization phase, a lot of the GDP growth was in exports, right? And then in the industrialization phase, a lot of the GDP growth was in, you know, building out infrastructure, right? Now we are getting to a phase where 2/3 of GDP growth is in consumption on the mainland, right? And actually 50% of that is in the digital economy. Okay. So I think in the next phase, there is a strong emphasis on trying to develop the internal ecosystem for the next stage of growth. And this actually is coupled with the fact that there's a lot of geopolitical tension, there's a trade war, and so the government needs to diversify and also find new factors for growth, right? But as you mentioned, I'm actually glad that you also mentioned the sort of dual circulation strategy. So, of course, the country cannot just depend on internal growth. There has to be a coupling to the international ecosystem. And so now there is this term called dual circulation, where there is the development of the internal ecosystem and the consumption growth. And then also related to that is the emphasis of how that couples to the international ecosystem. And we have these dual circulation in hopefully a positive feedback cycle to allow the country to develop in a more robust way.
I want to home in on the coupling angle more, especially with respect to the sort of CBDC ecosystem. But I think before we dive into that, I'm wondering if you can help us unpack the digital RMB as a technical endeavor a little bit more. I mean, I think most of our listeners will be broadly familiar with the sort of developments in CBDC, but maybe you can help us understand a little bit better how this PBOC project is distinct, what its sort of main features are from a technical payments perspective, things like that. Maybe we can start off with that.
Sure. So China has been actively researching the what we call the DCEP, the Digital Currency Electronic Payments, as an initiative since 2014. The People's Bank of China, the central bank, had set up a digital currency research institute to specifically focus on this. There was a lot of development. Actually, PBOC is one of the top patent holders worldwide of digital currencies and related blockchain technologies to support the intellectual property development of their ecosystem. And it's been slowly being developed all the way up until I think the sort of catalyst moment was when Facebook Libra was announced last June, in June of 2019. And that was a wake-up call, not just to China, for the whole world, right? Regulators around the world definitely took note of that, because Facebook, of course, is such a large company, you know, with over 2.3 billion users. That's more than China and India combined. So a private institution could have a systemic effect on the international monetary system. That was a wake-up call around the world. So China, in China's case, they decided to accelerate the development of DGCP and get it, you know, out in front of this. So by the end of 2019, we have Xi Jinping announcing at the fourth plenary sessions a very important set of official meetings, two major things. One was the official launch of the DCEP in the upcoming year, and then also the China's national blockchain strategy. These are the two major technologies that are relevant. Now, with respect to the actual technical implementation of the CBDC, it was designed as a two-tier system. So in that first tier, where the PBOC would be able to issue the CBDC to commercial banks, that is a fully centralized system. There's no blockchain involved at all. It is tightly coupled. Actually, in many ways, it's a very traditional sort of account-based electronic CBDC. But it was designed with the flexibility of potentially incorporating blockchain and even potentially tokenization or decentralized system in the second tier, where the commercial banks would transmit that CBDC to other ecosystems, like through Alipay or WeChat Pay, or potentially internationally on a blockchain rail. That optionality would be there. So it's quite flexible in that way. I think it would be, you know, good to mention that they had designed in degree what they call pseudo anonymity, ability to allow for anonymous sort of transfers. And so the way it works is that they care about things like anti-money laundering and you know, terrorist activity, sort of bad behavior. So they do need to monitor some form of this. And the way that they've done in terms of the design of the architecture, I think, is quite refined, in the sense that they monitored the fiat gateways into the ecosystem. So if you're actually going from a bank account, or you want to charge up your digital wallets with the new digital RMB, there are KYC checks at those gateways. So if you want to maybe deposit a certain amount, you have to do a standard KYC check on your phone. If you want to do a larger amount, you may have to go to a local branch office and do a more thorough KYC check. And so that way, you one, KYC the people who are on the system, as well as, you know, monitor the transfer of funds into the ecosystem.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I just want to go back to one of the things you mentioned earlier about the sort of two phases. You mentioned the sort of design aspects of the current phase, about it being account-based and centralized without sort of relying on a blockchain or DLT ledger. But then there's kind of this second potential phase that you touched on, where it's sort of more decentralized. What would be the catalyst or the rationale behind developing this project in that direction? I mean, would it take something specific for it to go in that more decentralized direction, or is it an inevitability? Just trying to understand the potential movement there.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you have to design for flexibility in the architecture to accommodate emerging use cases, right? So if we're just talking, for example, about a CBDC on the mainland, then a completely account-based centralized system would suffice for the domestic use case, right? But you can imagine different scenarios where that might not be the case. So for example, if and when the government wants to be able to internationalize the digital RMB, then a convenient way to do that is to create a tokenized form of that digital RMB. I actually encapsulate the fiat digital CBDC in a form that can have the full fungibility, perhaps, to be able to transfer across different blockchain ecosystems or different payment infrastructures, right? And so that's very hard to do if you have a very centralized system and it's an account-based system and that kind of thing. The architecture here, therefore, being a multi-tiered system, allows you for a future sort of growth paths and accommodates those types of new directions.
One of the things that I think you touched on this already a little bit, but I'd like to explore it a little bit more and get your thoughts is kind of the programmability of this project and how it relates to I think monetary policy is probably the most interesting angle. So I was wondering if you could kind of help the listeners kind of understand what it means for money to be programmable. I think that's quite an abstruse concept and what implications it might have for policymaking.
Yeah, so this is actually the most interesting area of innovation with respect to CBDC. Right now, we've just basically talked about digitizing a fiat-based currency, right? And that's actually already largely done through payment systems like Alibaba or WeChat Pay that we discussed before. So the only difference here is that the PBOC is a central bank, and therefore the payment of a CBDC is a liability for the central bank. And so it's basically government backed as opposed to in, say, the Alipay case. In theory, Alibaba could go bankrupt and then those liabilities would die with the company, right? So with respect to programmability, there's a whole new, almost infinite variety of innovation that could be enabled, right? In terms of allowing things like the use of funds, the tracking and tracing of funds. Okay. So now we can put a smart contract layer on top, i.e. an automated infrastructure layer that would allow you to, with very fine-grained precision, be able to program in things like potentially fiscal policy. So a good example of that is very relevant in the COVID-19 pandemic. There's huge amounts of stimulus, right? If you look at the original great financial crisis in 2008, and you looked at the hundreds of billions of dollars got pumped into the economy, and you look at where that money went, okay, a lot of it ended up going to the banks and industries like the airlines. And what the banks did was use that money to do stock buyback. So the theory was that you would give the money to the banks, and the banks would actually lend it out, and then it would trickle down to the common denominator in society, so that the money could be put to work to rebuild the economy. But what actually happened was a preponderance of that money went into a accounting trick to prop the stock prices for the 1%. And we didn't have that efficient transmission of fiscal policy, right? So with a programmable CBDC, you have the optionality of potentially programming in the specific use of funds. You can actually say this cannot go into stock buybacks. This has to go just for food stamps or for loans or for whatever thing you want of arbitrary complexity. And I think that is a very, very powerful concept. It is something that still needs to be explored, but it's something that would give the central bank a very powerful tool to be able to transmit fiscal policy and do so at a very fine grain resolution. And you see the first experiments of that happening in China now, right? China has recently initiated an experiment in Shenzhen, and actually more recently in Suzhou, where basically they wanted to stress test the usage of the digital RMB in the city. They gave 50,000 lucky residents a few hundred RMB each. And they gave those residents, I forget how long it was, but you know, a time limit is something like on the order of a week to spend it, right? And if they did not spend the money, then essentially that money would expire, right? And so that kind of is a simple toy case, right, of how programmability can work. But you can see where that could lead, right, the infinite amounts of innovation and the use cases that can result from something like that kind of functionality.
That's really interesting. One thing that comes to mind is the stark contrast to mailing out paper checks with Donald Trump's signature on them in the U.S. I mean, I think the implications are so incredibly wide-ranging. I mean, it was something like the transmission of negative interest rates seems like it would be much easier to put in place with that kind of programmable functionality. I like the examples that you gave, and I'd encourage our listeners to read more about those kind of trials of basically expiration dates on stimulus. I think it's a really interesting case study. You mentioned the kind of fungibility aspect, and you brought this up in the context of potentially internationalizing this digital renminbi by sort of tokenizing it. And I'm wondering, I mean, this is something that I think a lot of people struggle with in the context of this conversation or of this debate more generally, is what does it mean to internationalize a digital fiat currency? You know, I mean, what does it mean for the digital RMB to be used across borders? How would that work? How would that interact with FX markets?
Sure. I think before we talk about specifically internationalizing the RMB, let's talk about what that ecosystem looks like internationally as we speak, right? So because, again, of the Libra effect and actually the follow-on digital RMB announcements, that really catalyzed a lot of activity around the world. The BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, did a study and found that 80% of central banks around the world are now actively exploring CBDCs of their own, right? Actually, my understanding is something on the order of 50% of those central banks are now even going beyond just the initial sort of studies or proof of concept. So I think the world has flipped. Okay. And this is very interesting. I mean, just a few years ago, if you go to Davos and, you know, basically it was forbidden to really talk about Bitcoin or digital currencies. Nobody wanted to talk about it. But because now there was this catalyst, I think it really got a lot of the central banks to start to think about it. So there's this whole multitude of different experiments. You have Monetary Authority of Singapore doing Project Ubin. They're probably the furthest along. They're in phase five that just completed, and now they're going to full commercialization with JP Morgan, DBS, and Temasek. You have the work that's being done by the Swiss National Bank and SDX, the subsidiary of the Sixth Stock Exchange, and they're experimenting with their digital Swiss franc. You have the Banque de France issue, you know, announcing the digital euro project with eight different partners, Riksbank in Sweden. So you have a whole multitude of central banks around the world who are now test betting on this. And they're using all sorts of different technologies, right? Some of them are test betting on Ethereum. Actually, most of the early experimentation was on Ethereum because at the time, Ethereum was the only a real stable platform. But since that time, you know, Corda has come out, Hyperledger has come out, Tezos has come out, Algorand has come out, Stellar has come out. All sorts of, I would say, more enterprise-grade blockchains. And there's this whole ecosystem of different blockchain and other IT systems, you know, legacy systems for different payment rails for our RTGS payment schemes, all sorts of things like this, right? So in that ecosystem, then you have to ask the question, okay, so now if you look 3 to 5 years out and then you have maybe a dozen or two CBDCs are actually issued, how are these CBDCs going to talk to each other, right? How will they interact, right? From a technical perspective, therefore, you need to have interoperability, okay? So that's the next phase of discussion that I think the world is now starting to just talk about. You know, CBDCs are really going to take a few years. Okay, the ECB has just announced that they're going to look into it, and they're looking at 2024 or, you know, something like this, you know, a few years out before they do issuance, right? But right now would be a good time, and then people are starting to look at the technical aspects of CBDC interoperability, right? And what that means, therefore, is that these heterogeneous blockchain and legacy systems need to be somehow unified together and allow a cross-chain activity, let's say. And that's when we get to my previous point, which is basically that's hard to do if you're a CBDC to be able to be encapsulated in a way that it could have the ability to be atomically transferred, they call it. That's the technical term, to go from one blockchain and to be fungible onto another blockchain. Right. And so I think what will end up happening, right, just because of the technical requirements that will necessitate it, is that these CBDCs, when they start to cross between ecosystems, they will need to be tokenized. And so so we have a lot of experiments on this. And I think this is an evolving sort of space. It remains to be seen how it will actually pan out. But I think this is something that's extremely fascinating. And there are a few, I would say, leading efforts now. I mentioned before, Project Ubin is doing exactly that. They're trying to create a whole platform that will allow not just CBDCs to settle with each other. So to enable, for example, a synthetic digital currency FX market in the future. But also they're looking at digital assets as well. So, you know, there could be, in addition to CBDCs, private regulated stable coins, asset backed by fiat or other sort of collateral to create a digital currency, or digital assets in general, digital securities, digital commodities, and then all of those type of assets need to be settled against currencies as well. So what we call delivery versus payment or PVP, payment versus payment. These are the type of transfer schemes that need to be enabled to allow this robust ecosystem to grow. So we have a lot of experimentation. It remains to be seen how it will all evolve.
That was a very clear and easy to follow explanation. I think the sort of the leap that is often made in the discourse around this is going from technical internationalization and sort of figuring out how interoperability works. That's often kind of bypassed in this discussion, and people go straight to, the PBOC is digitalizing the renminbi, so that means that, the fall of the dollar is an inevitability, and it's often cast as sort of a serious challenger to US dollar hegemony. I think we agree that that's kind of an overhyped talking point. But I was wondering if maybe you can sketch your views on this angle, on the sort of the linkages between the digitalization of the RMB and kind of the broader global reserve currency environment.
That certainly is a very popular topic these days, and cast in the light of the trade war and now the sort of currency war that's happening between the United States and China. I have several points to make, right? One is that just because China is now going to issue their digital RMB, the magic of the digitization of the RMB doesn't change the strategy for how the RMB in general will internationalize that much. Okay. The technology is not the limiting thing, right? Most of the payments are already digital in some form or the other. Basically, the Chinese government needs to have a very thoughtful, long-term cadence and process for slowly opening up the capital accounts of the country to allow the RMB to internationalize, right? And that process is going to take, I would argue, decades, not in the next year. And without those capital accounts opening, then you will have a limitation in how the world will use the RMB as a reserve currency. They're not going to want to hold it if they can't convert it. And they would only want to hold it as a reserve currency if they could use it for either trade or to invest into products. And that requires that the Chinese government to open up the country to allow that to happen. And that will be a gradual process. So I do think that at least in the short term, this sort of talking point that the digital RMB is now somehow a new super weapon for China to, overthrow the US dollar, I think that is indeed quite overblown. That being said, I do think that the US dollar, which is represented by the sort of 75-year-old sort of Bretton Woods system, is probably due for an overhaul. If you look at most of the world, it's not just China. A lot of countries, I think the EU president and Lagarde from the ECB have been particularly vocal about this, are very interested in promoting the euro as a reserve currency that will gain in prominence. So I think every region or a territory or a country would naturally want their currency to become a more dominant status to the sort of currency in the international monetary system. And again, I think this is where technology is the great disruptor. Without any sort of technological innovation, it may have been that the US dollar would have been able to maintain its status for a much longer period of time. It's exorbitant privilege, as it's sometimes called, right? But because of the fact that, because of the catalyst that we've seen, we will see very clearly in the, say, 3 to 5 years to come, most of the central banks around the world, plus a bunch of private institutions, like Facebook, issuing their own digital currencies. And when that happens, and we solve this interoperability problem that we talked about, they can start to clear and settle with each other, and they can start to transact. Then the question to ask is, will these countries be beholden to using the dollar that they used to do, to be forced to? And I think that will lead to ultimately a resetting of the international monetary system, one where it will be more multipolar, one, of course, where the US dollar will have its still dominant role, because it has been so dominant for a very long time, but maybe one where it makes room for other up-and-coming currencies as well.
That's an interesting potential trajectory for sure. I mean, my own view on this has been changing, but my sense is that there's a growing recognition that the exorbitant privilege is actually, in a macro sense, it's quite a burden in that you have to be able to absorb a lot of shocks and sort of have a significant policy willingness to bear the brunt of being a reserve currency. A good note to end on, I think, looking forward. A very warm thank you to Michael for joining us today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you about the digitalization and internationalization of the renminbi, as well as the broader political economy of China's digital payments projects. To listen to more OnPiff podcasts, please check us out on our OnPiff channel. We are on Spotify and iTunes. If you enjoy listening, please do subscribe, or maybe even leave us a review if you're feeling particularly generous. Thank you.